Class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no war, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Iron Man Deese. Welcome to this episode of Class War Battlefield Podcast. How y'all doing? I made a decision some time ago, probably I'm thinking 2016, when I decided to bring the show back. I was really just going to kind of let it die, but I enjoyed doing it. So I made a decision. I said to myself, you know, if I'm going to do this, let me try not to get stuck in time. This was late 2016 after Donald Trump had become president, or president-elect. But I said, I don't want to get stuck in time. I don't just want to talk about things, you know, that if a person was listening to this podcast 30 years from now, they'd say, okay, he's talking about something that isn't relevant anymore. He's talking about things that, yeah, they were important during the day, but what does that have to do with now? I like history. And I am a big believer in what Albert Einstein said. History sure does not repeat itself. Or excuse me, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. And I do believe that. Sometimes what we experience in the past doesn't just impact the future, it actually occurs again in a different form in the future, the present to us, or to the people at least living through it. I've been thinking a lot, actually, about that concept over the last 6 to 8 to 10 months. Why is it that this society, Western civilization, doesn't seem to get the problems that undergird every disaster it creates for itself? And I want to be very, very honest here. All these problems are self-created. They are self-inflicted wounds by Western civilization. Why does it seem they can't learn? I'll tell you why, or at least this is my perception as to why. And it's a strange one because, especially in academia, there is an attempt to wipe out anything spiritual. You can't talk about spiritual concepts in academia. You got to talk about cold, hard, intellectual facts. That's what you got to do. And if you try to interject spirituality
then it better be religious in nature and not truthfully spiritual. It needs to be rooted in a religious tradition that leads to hierarchical expression that descends from the Most High down to the angels, down to us, pardon me, not us, but to the messengers from the angels and gods who proceed and look over us like they are our gods. That's what you need to be talking about. You can't speak about spiritual concepts in relationship to the concrete world unless you shift into metaphysics. And then, unless you're in certain circles, and I mean this, metaphysics doesn't actually have a standing on the real world unless you're in certain circles. If you're not in these certain circles, metaphysics is something fun to engage in. It's myth, it's philosophy, it helps you see the world in a different light, but you better not bring that light to the attunement of the world. Because the world is not attuned by light. It is attuned by facts. And facts and light don't seem to go together in academia. Thus, I can hear people talk, and I have been hearing them talk. I've heard white academics and white-inspired black academics all talk about economics as if economics is nothing but trivialized concepts based and rooted in empirical evidence that somewhat has an impact on everybody else's life only, and I emphasize the word only, if it impacts the stock market, if it impacts the people who will only grow richer from it. And I'm not talking society now. I have heard them talk as if the idea of the market is sacred, but no way is it connected to the real essence of what people are living. The market is somehow sacredly connected to everything that every person in this country does, and yet it is severed from it completely. This is how they talk about economics. I have heard them speak about capitalism as if it is natural for people to be fundamentally selfish, to be fundamentally distrusting of one another, to be fundamentally driven by betrayal. I've heard people talk like this. I've heard most economists talk like this. Competition is great, most economists say. Until, of course, it's not great. 2008, 1933, 1973. People don't like to talk about what happened in inflationary, the 1970s. Because it's scary. It shows what America could become overnight. Yet, I hear it nonetheless. What should have been learned in the 1970s was that you don't go deeper into competition, you go deeper into cooperation. The 80s was a direct result of the decision in the 1970s to embrace competition instead of embracing cooperation. So now the rhetoric of today is built. And when I say this, please understand what I mean. The rhetoric of today is built from the drug-fueled ancestral relationships of the 1970s, and I mean that. You have, from the 1970s, a group of philosophers, of dead-eyed destroyers, really nihilists, who couldn't see that what the world needed, or should I say didn't want to see, because it would have impacted them negatively, what the world needed. They couldn't see that what the world needed was more cooperation, not what had been done previously. And yeah, most of these people were drug-fueled. So then you get this massive push towards competition in the 1980s. Massive hostile takeovers. You had, you want to talk about a localized economy? This is something that is often not talked about, ladies and gentlemen. We talk about the jobs moving to China, but what we don't talk about is how they moved to China. Oh yes, the government, Nixon, Ford and Carter, all acquiesced to China, but not to China technically. They acquiesced to the class of people in this country who said, we need to send jobs over to China to build them up so they can be accounted to the Soviets. But we don't talk about how that happened. In the 1970s, the economy was still very decentralized. Deregulation, not only in the late 70s, everyone, you know, points to Carver. Carver, he deregulated this, he deregulated that. People don't understand that what Carver was setting up to do, the reason why he fired a number of his lieutenants in the latter part of his administration was because he was setting himself up to do something dramatically different in his second term. And that is why even the Democratic establishment went against him. Oh, the Democrats don't tell you about that. Carter played the game. And then said, I'm doing my own agenda for my second term. And they went after him. Jesse Jackson came from that same wing of the Democratic Party. As did Kennedy. And there was one of his nephews, I think, came from that same wing. And they knew that they couldn't let them win. And they went after him. But so, Carter started deregulation. But they wanted Reagan, and because Reagan wasn't only going to put deregulation on steroids, he was going to encourage another important part of the plan. The re-centralization of the economy. Under Reagan, the middle part of the 80s through the end part, and really the beginning of the 80s too, a new word became in vogue. And that is, actually it's a phrase, hostile takeover. If I understand it correctly, I know we don't use this much anymore, but if I understand it correctly, I'm going back about 10 years when I was interested in that type of thing, because I was wondering why you didn't hear it anymore. It is the purchasing of the stock of a company, purchasing a significant amount so you can become the controlling interest, then you can replace not only those in power, meaning the board, but you can also control, or excuse me, you can also get rid of management so that they can then do your bidding. And usually what that entails is you hostily, another bigger corporation will come into a smaller corporation and say, we want to buy you, offering them a ton of money. And if the person says no, then you go, okay, that's cool, that's fine. And then you systematically go about buying up enough stock till you get a controlling interest, and then you can get rid of those people who don't want you buying the company. Or, since you now own it, you just systematically absorb it. It could take 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 10 years. Usually a hostile takeover doesn't take 10 years. The reason why they were called hostile takeovers was because they occurred so rapidly and so quickly that by the time anyone became aware of what was actually happening, it was over. And so you had a collusion taking place in the 1980s between these medium and large size corporations and these big banking institutions, which underwrote a lot of these hostile takeovers, would give them, give big corporations exorbitant amount of money. I remember reading when I was about 7 years old, a brilliant article in one of the papers that no longer exists. I can't remember the name of it for the life of me. But they were talking in this article, it was about half a page, and I was just massively captivated, you know, to imagine 7 years old sitting and reading a paper, you know, like it was one of your favorite storybooks. And I was reading it, and it was talking about how this company, this regional company, which had, I want to say 1,500 to 2,500 employees, had its workforce chopped down to about 10%. It had recently exchanged hands for like the fifth or sixth time in a 2-year period. And it had exchanged hands not because it was sold, but because this major company had been going around absorbing all of these other medium companies. And what they had done, brilliant move, is they would act like they were the friends of this medium-sized company, and then they would say, okay, you know, we're going to help develop you. And they would give them all this capital to go out and absorb all of these other companies, usually through hostile takeovers, but also through, you know, just buying the companies and what have you, mostly through hostile takeovers. And then they themselves would suddenly get rid of all of the managers, and then hostily take over that medium-sized company, along with any of the strategic partners that they had made. And thus, they grew, you know, stupendously. And this company, which had been a really, really good a job provider, actually paid really good wages and such like that. The reason why they actually had really good benefits, really good retirement benefits, all of that. The reason why the workforce had been cut wasn't because of it wasn't because of automation. It wasn't even because they weren't making a profit. This company was tremendously prosperous. They were making a great profit. You know why? Money. It saved the bigger company money. Now, they had a really good product. And I remember in the article, they actually spoke about how customer complaints, since they had been hostily taken over, had increased some insane number, like 2,000%. And I remember asking, I think I asked my mother, either my, it was my mother or my father. I can't, I actually, now that, yep, it was my father. And I remember asking my father, I said, you know, Dad, what does it mean by 2,000%? And my father, in his gruff way, said, take 100 times about 20. I'm like, yeah, but what does that mean? And he's like, well, 100 is whatever you have to begin with, and then you times that by 20. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, wow, that's a lot. You know, I was 7 years old reading this and just intrigued by this. But this was uncommon. And what ultimately happened was that company shut down, I think, within 4 or 5 years. I'm not even sure if it was 4 or 5 years, but they did ultimately shut down. They went from employing 1,500 people, maybe even 2,500, to between 150 to 250, and then gone. You want to understand how companies ended up in China? It was through this process. And this is not something we talk about. Because it is a part of history. It is a part of history that is tragically, tragically sad for America. Why? Because a lot of the unions at the top level, these corporatized unions, these centralized unions, stood by and let it happen. They said, as long as my job is safe, as long as my regional job is safe, my position is safe, let it happen. So first, jobs went from one state where taxes funded a really good quality of life and standard of living to states where the government said, do whatever the hell you want. We don't care. Beat the employees if you want. We don't care. Just bring us jobs. And then even when the people of those states started saying, man, this is nuts. I'm moving to this state or this state or that state or that state because quality of life down here stinks. The free market at work. Oh, people should be able to go where they want to find the job which would give them the life that they want. It's a lie. It's a lie. Because they don't want you to have the life that you want. They want you to have the life that they want to give you. And that's a point that needs to be made. So when people started moving out, then the company said, well, we're not getting the type of employee that we want. So we want to bring down costs. We want to pay them less. Not always in this order, by the way. Sometimes they said, we want to pay them less. And the state said, no, we're not doing that. Or the state, under pressure from its citizenry, said, look, we need to hike how much you're paying, maybe even raise a little bit of taxes. And then the companies became angry and said, well, we're going to move to another state. Or they moved to China or to Thailand or to Vietnam or to wherever else they could go and abuse people even more. Understand that. I am not joking. They went to places where they could abuse people more. I keep telling you, you're dealing with a psychopathic entity. Corporations are psychopathic entities. They went to where they could inflict the most harm and damage onto human beings. That's what a psychopath does. Don't tell me it's equal to me. It isn't. Animals have better capabilities of doing what is naturally correct than corporations. They are not equal. They will never be equal. They are not sentient beings. They are not beings. They are creations. And their form, which is created, is hollow. So this history isn't talked about much because the history is rooted in one thing. Oh, this is the great part about it. It is the drive against the socializing ethic. We don't even know what that is anymore. the socializing ethic. What is it? The socializing ethic is the need for communitarian living, the need for cooperative living, the need for just living, the need for mature living, not only for the individual, but for the whole entire community. We strive to share with one another. We strive to desire to be with one another. We love the idea of community, of common worth, of commonwealth. That is the socializing ethic. Rather, you're talking about tribes, nations, customs, cultures. These are all socializing ethics. A nation is merely many tribes deciding to be connected. Nothing more, nothing less. A commonwealth is merely many cultures deciding to align for the betterment, the perpetuation, the regeneration of the whole. The commonwealth is a powerful concept. It supersedes nations. Nations can be in a commonwealth because customs can spread over multiple tribes. And then the commonwealth takes up multiple customs and says, we are going to regenerate ourselves, we are going to perpetuate ourselves based on our unity towards the ends of perpetuating wealth. And don't get it twisted. I'm not talking monetarily, materialism right now. I am talking about something greater. This is the spiritual aspect of it. This is that which goes beyond it. We don't understand this history because it's not rooted in a form which encourages us to not repeat it. If we lived in a society where we were encouraged to be better than that which had come before us, that which had implemented mistakes, if we were in a society which said, learn from those mistakes, finish a great work, if we were in a society which demanded that from us, this type of history would be known by the first grade. Because our parents, our grandparents, the state as a whole, which is hollow unless you give it form, the form which our state currently holds is corporate. You can have a state which is a commonwealth. You can have a state which is fascist, a state which is authoritarian, a state which is republican, a state which is democratic. All of those levels, though, they would demand from us the adherence the adherence to correcting that which had been mistakenly done. But we don't live in a society which demands that from us. And we should. Hostile takeovers, offshoring of massive, massive economic structures. The betrayal by corporate unionists. I should talk a little about that, I suppose, but I'm going to try not to. The betrayal by corporate unionists, all of this led us to this point in time when everything is dead. Everything is dead. And we feel it. We sense it. This is the spiritual helplessness that is engulfing everything. But here's the hope, but also the challenge. History tells us that every so many years, this seems to happen. When I study spiritualism, or spiritual aspects in reality, what I see is there is this concept which many Europeans are starting to become very familiar with. It is called reincarnation. Many of you don't believe it. Many of you do believe it. But I have found in my conversations with people who consider themselves to be conscious European metaphysical students who want the best for the planet. When I talk to them about reincarnation, they have a self-centered view of it. A view which is disconnected from environments and from the total stage history itself takes on. It is disconnected from the properties. It is disconnected from the properties that we ourselves know history is shaped around. History is shaped around communities. It is shaped around kingships. It is shaped around nations. It is shaped around the interactions between cultures and customs. So when I would engage in conversations with many people about their reincarnation experiences through meditation and what have you, they would always talk to me about individual experiences. I would read people's blog posts where they said, oh yeah, you know, I did this meditation, it was great, it was wonderful. I found out that in another lifetime, 400, 500 years ago, I was a soldier in the Spanish army who was killed. Okay, well, how were you killed? Oh, I was killed in some battle. Okay, well, what battle was it? It was some battle in Mexico, maybe. Like, wait a minute. Whoa. What were you doing in Mexico as a Spaniard? Well, if it was 500 years ago, we knew what they were doing in Mexico as a Spaniard. They were conquering, pillaging, and killing. That's what they were doing. Edgar Cayce, among other people, but he, I think, is the most prominent when it comes to European thought on this concept, says when you go back and you see these reincarnated or these images from
a past life. Pay very close attention because they have something to do with the present. You can only see them because they're relevant to this life. That was the only reason why he could see him. If you don't know who Edgar Cayce is, do some research. C-A-Y-C-E, Edgar C-A-Y-C-E. So it's relevant to now. That's what he said. Many others said it too. But I happen to like him because he is more succinct. Well, if it's relevant to now, how is it relevant? Oh, now that's the important part. You meditate and you find out the relevance. You gotta look at it, see what it's talking about, and then pull it out. Because there's a reason why you're seeing that. The problem, and I've mentioned this a few moments ago, is that the relevance isn't just isolated to you. It's relevant for your family, for your community, for your nation, for your custom. There's a relevancy that spreads. That spreads. But if you aren't capable of seeing that point, then isn't it quite probable that you will make the same disastrous mistakes you made in that previous life? Because it's easy to just go to the important things. How'd you die? What did you do for fun? Okay, you were fighting in a war. But how did you get to go to the military? Why did you choose that? What did you leave behind when you went to that war? I mean, how does all of that fit? How does it all fit? And does any of it possibly relate to now? One of the interesting blog posts that I read years ago had to deal with the fact that the individual discovered through meditation, it seemed to discover through meditation, I don't know the person, so I can't say definitely, but that a previous girlfriend that he had dated, that he was very connected to, was in fact, in a previous life, a wife that he had loved and adored magnificently. But they couldn't be together in this lifetime. Moreover, his best friend seemed to be his brother in that lifetime. And a friend who had passed away early in life had succumbed to a similar disease in that lifetime and died not of young age, but of old age. Kind of shocked him when he found that out. So there was a lot of reflection there. And if you read Edgar Cayce, I would definitely encourage you to do that, you would see that that is not by accident. It is to make you feel at home. Okay, I've seen this before. It's kind of like when you're playing video games and you have to shut off the video game because you have to go to bed or go to work or go to school, and you pick it up in 2 days and you decide to go back a little bit and then go forward. Oh, I've seen this before. This is not new. Or you are going forward and you're going into this area and you've done a little bit of research. And you get into this area and you say, oh, I was just reading this in the code book. It is specifically made similar so you understand that this is nothing new. You can do this. You know about this. But what if you don't know about it? What if you think deja vu is nothing to be paid attention to? Isn't it probable that you will make the same mistakes? I often wondered,
in the books that I've read from Edgar Cayce, in the books that I've read from European authors who have spent lifetimes, or seeming lifetimes, writing about past lives, not many of them have ever come across people who say are, or were, people, members of the Ku Klux Klan, members of, well, I haven't actually read anything to confirm the whole Nazi thing, but, you know, it's just like the Ku Klux Klan or the upper British royal house of whatever, or, you know, royalty here, royalty there. I know there's some people who claim it, but outside of a few isolated cases, many of those things are not reported. I don't believe it's because those people aren't being incarnated. I believe that many of those people are being incarnated, and yet when they are read for, you know, because many of these people who have the books that I've read, Edgar Cayce was well known among not only non-elite circles, but elite circles. People with tremendous amount of money would go to him for readings. The same thing with Sylvia Brown. The same thing with numerous authors that I have read. And I have, some of them I haven't read, some of them I've just heard of. You know, took a glance at their work and just, you know, was like, okay, this is good stuff, but it's not really different than anything I've read before. These people who are getting paid thousands of dollars to sit down with very wealthy people aren't going to write in a book. Oh yeah, I sat down with this guy who gave me $10,000 to read for him, and it turned out that he was a Grand Dragon in the Ku Klux Klan. Or it turned out that he was some high-ranking Nazi, or that this person had presided over the brutal execution of 1,000 people in this, you know, as a general in this war. Or this person had control over this huge economic engine in Southeast America, in Southeast United States, and ultimately led it to collapse. They're not going to write that. They're not. They're not going to do it because, one, they won't ever get picked to read for these people again. And trust me, they do get picked to read for them again. As much as you like to read these type of things, trust me when I tell you, the wealthy flock to this stuff. There's a book that I found on astrology in the marketplace. And in the back of the book, there's actually a list of other books that you can find and read about astrology. Some of them have to do with the marketplace. Some of them just has to do with interpreting astrological aspects. So these people, they go to these things. They read about these things. Astrology is very important. Very important. That is one of the reasons why many corporations in the United States adopt Jewish concepts in organizing the structures and organizing the structures of their companies and launching specific products. Because the Jews, unlike the rest of us, utilize multiple calendars just like the Chinese. Just like the Chinese. So energy is very important to these people. Note, you can look at any celebrity you want to. If you go throughout their history, you will see that sometime or another, they've talked about energy. They've talked about it. I don't want to get lost on that road, but, you know, this is to kind of open your eyes. See what the world really is about. Because it is my belief that the reason why we keep going through this process is because the same group of beings that we have been trying to convince to do otherwise. Keep reincarnating and keep making the same stupid mistakes. They keep making the same stupid mistakes. And why do I say that? Because you cannot have consistently and constantly nation after nation falling in similar ways without there not being a change in leadership strategy and the leadership all together. These people should have learned by now. These people know history better than us. So if they know history, they should know not to do these things. Unless they keep making the same mistakes because they're the same entities. Sounds far-fetched, sounds crazy. I know. But I'm still proposing it. Because it is increasingly looking like we are going to take the same road that Rome took and Greek took and a whole bunch of others took. Because we haven't learned. And I do mean we. See, because it's easy to look at the elite and say, well, it's just the elite. It's just the people at the top. But it's not. It's not. We have become complacent. It's easy, so we have become complacent. And because we have become complacent, we have become disheartened. And because we have become disheartened, we have become motivated. We've become motivated by lethargy, by just sitting still, hoping that things get better, hoping that things improve. We can't do that anymore. The natural question which arises is, okay, so these are the same entities, then what can be done? What should be done? Well, there is the difficult part. I'm not 100% sure about that. I may not even be 50% sure. The one point that I think can be, should be, must be made is we really do have to know better who we are as individuals and groups. What is it that we want out of life? What is it that we want in life? Because, see, we don't have conversations about that anymore. We argue about politics. We argue about sports. We argue about television shows. We have conversations about all that stuff. But we don't have reflective conversations with one another. What is it that you truthfully want from life? What is it truthfully that your neighbor wants from life? We are afraid to have those conversations because we have been made afraid of the socializing ethic. We have been injured so much by this society, by us taking on the idea of competition. We have been injured so much by the society that we can't even contemplate the possibility of working together. Not everybody, but far too much of us. So we can't even have this conversation. I remember there's this joke that goes around with progressives where they say hurting progressives is as easy as hurting cats. And they used to say this a lot. They don't say it anymore. But it's kind of true. It is kind of true. But see, they only explain it by saying, well, it's because everybody has an opinion. Which is funny because I started talking about facts at the beginning of this, right? But they do. They'll say, oh, well, everybody has an opinion. Okay, how about instead of worrying about the opinion, how about we worry about the need? The need. See, when you start talking about needs, you get into weird circumstances. And I guess I don't mean weird. You get into this idea of, well, what then is a need? You know, I've heard people ask that question. What is a need? I mean, we need justice. Actually? Yes, you do need justice. But to what extent? Where do you begin justice at to fulfill a need? In fact, justice may not be the first thing you need. If you look at Maslow's hierarchy, Maslow gives you an idea of what real needs are. Then you take that hierarchy and you place it next to FDR's Second Bill of Rights, and you find something very interesting. You find out what real needs are and the policy decisions that require our attention to fulfill those needs. Most progressives will admit needs are food, shelter, clothing, and a means of keeping all of those things. You talk to the Amish. The Amish will tell you that to have meaningful work is part of a need. To have a meaningful, dedicated community is part of a need. To have family relationships that are built on trust and honor, pride, that's part of a need. And yet, you talk to progressives about the need. And I bet you they're going to start with things like justice, things like LGBTQ rights, black rights. I'm a black person. Absolutely. I need black rights. But I need black rights first and foremost as it relates to food, shelter, clothing, the right for my community to be unified and to do right by our families. That's a need. Those are needs. If we started with needs, the world would change overnight. This is spiritual. This is spiritual. If you start with needs, the world will change overnight. It is spiritual. Which is one of the reasons why you can't talk spiritual in the academy. Because in the academy, it isn't about meeting needs. It's not about meeting needs. It's about career. It's about meeting a desire for career and defining yourself by that career, and then defining yourself by your by the discipline, which is a horrible word for it because academia is not about discipline, but by the school of thought, I guess, that you attach yourself to. I mean, it's not about the need. And this is not to say that academia has not tried to be about the need. It did. But when you get rid of social workers, when you get rid of the leftists, real leftists, not this bullcrap progressivism that they talk about now, when you get rid of real leftists, you get rid of that socializing ethic that was interwoven in the academy. They got rid of the socializing ethic just like they started purging the socializing ethic out of the upper elite. FDR saved capitalism, absolutely. But ladies and gentlemen, the man was a socializing ethic enforcer. That's what he was. He recognized that in order to save the country, you had to implement a socializing ethic, or else the country would be doomed. And they couldn't have that, so they had to get rid of people like FDR. And that has been the fight. It's been against the socializing ethic, which is spiritual. It is spiritual. And this other ethic, which is purely physical. I don't even know what to call this other ethic. The corporate ethic, corpus ethic, corpus ethic. I don't know what to even call it. Competitive ethic. I don't even think that does it justice. Because the reality is, even if you call it competitive ethic, this stuff isn't about competition. You can have a competition to better your society. And this isn't that. So I don't even know what to call it, but it's something. It's something. We need to understand, though, and before I wrap this up, that our task now is to take this socializing ethic and to build it into structures which now can feed not only ourselves but our communities and beyond. That is what we must do. That may mean organizing financially, it may mean organizing educationally, it may mean a host of things, but we have to define this socializing ethic, and then we have to implement it. And it is not about bringing power to one person or two people. It is about bringing power back to the people. Pure and simple. This will require us to start making moves economically that are going to benefit the entire community. We are going to have to make decisions to decentralize various aspects of our utilities. Don't forget, this is the things we are now living in, an era which took about 20 years to implement. From the late 1970s to about the early 2000s, that is when all of this hyper centralization took place. And it was step by step by step. Just as it took step by step by step to implement, it will take a couple of steps to shatter it. And it will shatter. Why? History tells us it will. Just as they keep making the mistake of doing this stupid stuff, history keeps undoing their mistake. The question is, the last two times we had to undo it, it cost a lot to undo it. World War I did not prevent hyper-monopolization, but it did, in some instances, stop it in this country. And then when industrial monopolization seemed to kind of wane a little bit, the financial monopolization went through the roof. If I have my history correct in my mind. World War II definitely stopped it. World War II cut it badly. Put it down. And then we went backwards. And now we're in a time period where we again must find the strength and the knowledge and the wisdom to undo it. And that's going to mean implementing a spiritual practice that's going to help us move through it, strengthen us so we can do the work that we need to do, and building. Hope you're ready. I want to thank you all for listening. I know this was this was something different. If you have questions, comments, concerns, please reach out to me. Also, if you are carrying this, I know I made the call last year. Again, you know, let me just quickly say, you know, family, I've been, it's been an interesting year. It's been one of those years that I'm not going to forget for a long time. It's been a tough year. But it's been a year well worth it. you know. It's been a year well worth it, and I've come through a lot and learned a lot. And so trust me when I tell you, you know, this I have a deeper appreciation for this podcast than I did before. I openly can admit that. I think I took advantage of it for a long time, just the ability to be able to do it, the ability to articulate myself well enough to do it. I took advantage of it, and I very much am glad, and I'm honored. You know, I'm glad to be doing it, and I'm honored that you give me a moment of your day or week or month to speak to you, because there's a million podcasts out there, and yet you're here listening to me. So if you listen, do me a favor. Drop me a line. Tell me what you see in this podcast. I might read it. But if you also carry the podcast, whether it's a website that you carry it on, whether it's a radio station, let me know. I will definitely give you a shout out. Till next time, my friends. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alone.